Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Now You're Up with Alicia and Josh. And boy, do we have a show that we thought we were going to have. Well, before we get into it, first, Alicia, my condolences to Spain, but it wasn't the most humiliating performance of the day. We can...
Small victories.
It really is, man. It really is. Like, with Spain, it's just the end of an era. Like, that's a lot easier to swallow that your dynasty is over than what should be the makings of a dynasty petering out to a nation of 220,000 people.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, there will always be, at least we're not England. And, you know, like you said, like, I feel like as a Spain fan, I went into this tournament expecting this a little bit. And as soon as Spain drew Italy, I sort of was sitting there expecting it a little bit, and that Italy was just a really tough matchup, the Achilles heel in many ways for what Spain can and can't do at this point with their system. And, you know, the plus side is that now I get to watch this tournament a little bit like you, like with the Dutch being not involved, is that you just sort of get to sit
Believe
back
these,
and go like...
This Icelandic team that's doing really well right now came out of our group. So,
right, it's making you feel better, right?
Right. They're in now the quarterfinals. I actually feel better about a fledgling Dutch youth system.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like one of those in college football when you lose early in the season and then at the end of the season you look back and like, oh, that loss doesn't look so bad anymore. Like that team turned out to be pretty damn good. But yeah, now I get to just watch the tournament as like just free of rooting interest, and I can just root for storylines. I can root for Iceland, and I can just enjoy the sport more than, you know, having the stress of like, Spain's going to do this and Spain needs to do that. So yeah, but I mean, I'm taking positives from it.
Well, let's get right into that England performance, because it's obviously going to be the much bigger storyline, both in the national media and on Twitter. I am happy to say that here on this show, we are not going to make any crappy Brexit jokes. Like,
too many.
Way too many. And Mighty Ducks 2 jokes are also out unless they're extremely clever. You know, just looking at that performance from England, so 4 minutes into the game, Raheem Sterling does a good thing. And he draws the penalty that Wayne Rooney then buries to give England a 1-0 lead. Not even 2 minutes later, Iceland, and I can't remember, I think it was Sigurdsson that scored the first goal and Stig Thorsson that scored the second goal. I hope that's right. Whatever it was a son.
I'm going to trust your pronunciation of those names better than my pronunciation could possibly be. It was something along those lines.
Somebody with the last name S-O-N scored early, and somebody with the last name of S-O-N scored late for Iceland. And in addition, all three subs had the suffix S-O-N that came on. So we know that much to be the case, but from the outset, it looked like England's speed, and you commented on this on Twitter, Alicia. You said, like, I thought the speed would be the difference, and here it is early. And then that was the literal last time that England's speed was the difference in that game.
Yeah, my kiss of death was swift and useful. Because, you know, it did look like Sterling was giving the center back a fit there, and it just sort of had the feel like, well, there it is. Iceland's spirit is going to break. And obviously that was not true. And what really made the difference is how quickly Iceland went back and pulled one back. And as soon as that happened, it was anyone's game again. And I think Iceland responded. I mean, obviously they went and grabbed a goal, but Iceland responded to the England goal with energy and can be attitude.
I want to ask you something, because you mentioned this yesterday, or was it 2 days ago, about Ireland. You said they scored too early against France. When you look at this Iceland goal, did the fact that they so scored so early, right after England, do you think that that was really sort of like the wedge that broke this team today? Like, I mean, England has to be feeling pretty good about themselves. And, I mean, that wasn't just any old goal that they scored. That thing was a work of art. They straight just crushed them. And the second goal was completely Joe Hart's fault. But you had mentioned that too soon can be a bad thing. In this case, it felt like it served the exact opposite purpose.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, you can actually apply the scored too early thing to England, because England gets that early goal. I'm sitting there. You're sitting there. Everyone's sitting there thinking like, oh, well, there it is. England's goal. They're going to romp. And then, you know, that Iceland comes back so early and brings it back crushes England's spirit. England thought that they had this in the bag, I think, when they scored in the fourth minute. And obviously they didn't, and they didn't respond to the adversity very well in a very English way. Like, this is the way that England flames out of tournaments, is just by not being mentally strong enough and by, you know, for lack of a better term, like losing their shit when things go wrong.
Your shit can be a great thing if you look at the other game earlier today with Antonio Conte, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah, I mean, well, and this is why the context of both of these games is interesting, because you sort of would have expected Iceland to go out and try to, you know, survive a storm against England with a one-goal lead and sort of do what Italy did, where they just sit back and be compact and you know, Spain were frustrating me to no end, but Spain were still, you know, out there trying to attack. At a certain point, they seemed to have figured out that they needed to change some of their strategies and start going aerial. They went to two up front, all this kind of stuff. Whereas with England, it's like they went down to Iceland and then just didn't have, not only were they clueless as to what to do, not only were they toothless in their attack in the first place, but the players just couldn't even string together basic passes. Like, couldn't even could just complete the most basic parts of being
a
soccer
player. I mean, Harry Kane's free kick, the one that, you know, was a worse miss than what we saw out of Granit Xhaka in the Swiss-Polish shootout. I've never seen anybody, like, I mean, I don't know how you miss that far to the right when you have that free kick on the left. Like,
yeah,
that was an astonishing, like, Ian Dark at that point, I think, probably just threw something down, I imagine. He and McMenamin had just about had it. Like, if England had found a way to score and, like, pushed it to extra time, like, I'm not sure that McMenamin and Dart could have handled another 30 minutes of English ineptitude. But what's curious to me is that, you know, Raheem Sterling took the vast majority of the criticism early on that I saw on Twitter. Well, Raheem Sterling was the dude who got the penalty in the first place. Like, it was because of Sterling's quick wit that England were able to get on the scoreboard to begin with. It was not his fault that Joe Hart allowed in yet another howler. And it was not his fault that the English defense paid no mind to Iceland on the set piece. I think when you look at this tournament, or excuse me, this game, between the free kicks, between the just the errant passes that Rooney misplaced, the simple giveaways. I remember one sequence of events down toward the end of the game when Iceland had pushed into England's final third, and one of the attacking players mistakenly kicked the ball into an area that he thought was being covered by a teammate, and immediately, like, was like, oh, crap, I just turned it over because there was an English player right there. Well, he didn't have to hate himself for too long, because literally the next touch was him giving it back to Iceland. And you're just like, that sums up the entire game right there for England. Like, even when things go your way, you somehow turn them into a mistake.
Yeah, and that's part of the mental side of the game, where England had the players to serve. I mean, to score more than one. Well, England had the players has the players to score a goal from the run, you know, from the field of play instead of just the penalty. But England's players, just no one showed up to play. And I think McManaman pointed out that, like, it seems like every single player in a white shirt decided to have their worst game for England ever on the same day at the same time. And I think part of that is just, you know, they didn't walk up to the stadium and decide, like, oh, we're just going to suck today. I think they didn't respond to the early setback of Iceland, you know, pulling back to a draw, let alone the second Iceland goal. And, you know, you see those frustrations. Like, yeah, Raheem Sterling is, you know, I've said this for a long time, Raheem Sterling is not a perfect player, but he's also exceedingly young, probably shouldn't be in the position he's in with the amount of responsibility that he's been given by Hodgson in this tournament. But you have Rooney, who is just having his worst game in that midfield of the tournament.
Rooney couldn't fire a set piece for the life of him.
Oh,
I
no.
Mean,
Rooney,
they were awful.
Rooney was awful. Harry Kane was just not on top of things. Daniel Sturridge was frustrated, and you could see him doing that thing where he just starts dropping deeper and deeper and deeper, trying to get a touch of the ball. And, you know, that's counterproductive in the end, because then one of your forwards is sitting back, picking up the ball off of a center back, and it's just, that's not going to string together good offensive play. You have all of these problems that are going on, and you know, for me, I put this all on Hodgson. I don't think he sets up his team properly. I think he doesn't respond well enough to problems with the setup in game. Like, for instance, Rooney's having a rough game. You have guys on the bench, and I, you know, I'm a Liverpool fan, so I'm partial to Jordan Henderson. But I think Henderson's energy and running might have been useful in that game. You have Jamie Vardy that you have to bring on. You let Rashford, who you're in the 80th minute and you need a goal to tie this thing up, and you have Rashford ready to come in, and you wait 5, 6, 7 minutes to get him on the pitch until there's 3 minutes left in the game. Like, the McManaman and Dark were slating Hodgson for that, but, like, it's absolutely true. Why are you waiting that long?
What do you think's going to happen in 3 minutes? Like,
exactly.
The hope there?
Give your players – I mean, if you need – managers are going to screw up. They're going to set out the wrong team. The players are going to be crappy when they don't expect them to be crappy. You know, this kind of stuff happens. But it's how you respond to it, and you have to get those substitutions in quickly enough for them to settle into the game and then change the game. And, you know, a player like Rashford can change the game. He's very young, like Sterling. But if he has a bright moment, then you can get out of this mess that you've created for yourself. But you can't do that when there's only 2 minutes left in the damn game. It's just not going to work. So,
is there a sense, though? You mentioned that England has the talent. We say that, but do they? Because
I think they do.
By all accounts necessary, Sterling and Rashford are very young, very raw talents. The same thing goes with John Stones, who I don't think saw a minute of action in this tournament, to my knowledge. There are, of course, talented players on this team, but when you talk about overall, I guess you could say, placement in the talent sphere, I'm not sure that England's best player is Wayne Rooney, who hasn't been something to write home about maybe since he was like 26, 27 years old, since like 2009.
Well,
And I'm not saying that I think you made an excellent point when you mentioned that a lot of these players are being put in places that are not meant for them to thrive. They're not designed or set up to ensure a decent amount of success. And if you have young, not going to say underdeveloped players, but players waiting to be developed, I don't know that just putting them on there because they can do nifty things with the ball at their feet means that they're talented.
There has to be a certain amount of game intelligence.
You look at guys like Hazard or De Bruyne, or so on and so forth, it seems to me that the tournament, the teams with the big names and the big egos are not playing as well as the units. And I wonder if that doesn't go down to the fact that maybe some of these teams that look at their managers, who look at their starting 11 and say, I've got to have these names in there because people know them. And if I don't play them, I'm going to be asked tough questions. And because I don't have a decent game plan, which is another point that you brought up when you look at a guy like Hodgson, because I don't have the answers to the questions that are being asked of me, I'm not going to play those players. I'm going to play the guys that I know how to play and continuously put them in positions where they're going to fail. And I think that that's what's ended up happening.
Well, yeah, for sure. And that's one of my big criticisms of just Hodgson as a manager, because he is definitely the kind who will just say, well, we're going to be in 4-4-2 or something like it, whatever you want to call it. We're going to throw out, you as an individual are good players. Therefore, when I put you out there, you're going to figure it out because you're a good player. But that's not, I mean, the sport is so much more complex than that. And there's a reason that teams like Leicester and Iceland and all of these, you know, little teams are able to be successful here and there is because, you know, setups do matter. And I mean, but getting back to like, is England a talented enough team? I really think they are talented enough, certainly, to get out of the first round. Like, this isn't like Spain drawing Italy in the first round. Like, Iceland have been extremely impressive, and I love this story, but a team like England should still be able to figure them out and should still be able to overpower them, given the players and the
football history
that they have. But
what about the team that they're putting out there is so world-class? I mean, you got guys like Chris Smalling, okay, Gary Cahill, okay. I mean, Eric Dyer wasn't even around today. There are a lot of guys on there who are super young and probably will be really, really good in the future. At least that's the hope.
But here's my point. For instance, Adam Lallana, who has been perhaps one of England's best players at the tournament so far, doesn't see the pitch today. And he gets taken out in favor of one of those really talented young players who can't always necessarily be relied upon in Sterling, who, you know, a lot of people weren't sure he was even going to get back in there, and Hodgson throws him back out there. Obviously, you know, that comes with some good moments and that comes with some bad moments. But you still have players of the caliber of Daniel Sturridge. You still have players of the caliber of Jamie Vardy. You still have a Wayne Rooney caliber kind of people out there. And I'm not saying that, you don't need to have world-class players to have a great team or a team that's capable of competing in this tournament. If you have a team that knows itself, that has an identity, and that is set up to get the most out of good, like, I mean, to a man,
which this team is
good players.
So why were we saying, and I'm saying this and we all knew it wasn't coming into
Right, exactly. And these were the, you know, I was looking at England, and every time I talked about England, you know, leading up to this tournament, it was like, they should be really good. They have players to be really good, but they don't, you can't trust Hodgson to put out the system to be really good. And then you look at you look at what Iceland can do with players who are not European level. I mean, I don't think anyone could look at this team and say that, you know, that this is a team full of people who would be at home in some of the top clubs in Europe, but that doesn't matter. It's because they know their jobs and they go out and do their jobs. And if you have an England team with this level of talent, which is not, you know, it's not so great. It's not, you know, you're not fielding like a Barcelona or a Bayern Munich here with literally the best players in the world. But you have enough good players that if you were to give them some direction, if you were to give them a system that then they had jobs, they were going to go out there and do those jobs and do them with energy, then they would be successful. And I'm not saying that they would, you know, win every game. But they certainly wouldn't lose games like that, which is, I think, the problem that England fans and just soccer fans in general watching that, saw it. It's not necessarily that England lost that game. It's that they lost it looking so out of
sorts.
Iceland
spent most of that game playing defense and never looked bothered. They actually looked comfortable.
I mean, and that's, you would expect it to be a barrage, right? A barrage of attacks, a barrage of shots on goal, just like a Iceland hanging on and hanging on and hanging on, and it getting tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter, and they just they're just hanging on for dear life. At no point was Iceland hanging on for dear life. Not at one single point can I remember there being a sustained attacking pressure. And I mean personally, I have to believe that if England were a more organized force, that those players would be capable of tightening the noose on a team like that, turning the screw. It's just that this team is exactly what this team is. Like, you could see it from a mile away, and the only way that this team was going to advance was if, say, Jamie Vardy went out of his mind and just blew everyone away. If Harry Kane had, you know, put in some of the greatest performances in the history of the Euros, if these players had come out and had singularly great individual performances, it might have been different, but none of them did. So this is what you're left with.
And I'm curious if that same mentality is going to hinder France when they meet them. We kind of hinted on it, but we can get to that a little bit later. Obviously, as a result of this game, and we don't probably need to spend too long talking about it because we just outlined every single reason why the following happened. Hodgson gave a press conference, no questions afterwards. You can probably figure out where this is going. And basically stated that he would not be back after the Euros. It was time for him to turn over the reins. Did so stating that his contract was always going to be up, but it wouldn't have mattered. It wouldn't have mattered. He was going to be done today, the very next press conference he gave. I think I tweeted, Roy Hodgson, after today, may as well just resign with the first words he gives. And that's what he did. The very first press conference he gave was him resigning. And that's really all he needed to do.
He only needed two words, just "I'm out." Maybe a piece there. And then, you know, everyone knew it was coming.
Throw up the Lane Kiffin and just turn around and walk out. A 30-second press conference.
Hodgson pulling a Kiffin would have been beautiful. The greatest thing that Hodgson ever did. There's no question. No, it's a no-brainer. The England team has not progressed under Hodgson. I don't think they were ever going to progress. The real question now is, you know, where does the FA go? I was sitting here after the game thinking, who should England go after? Like, you know, because I've been very negative around Hodgson, and whenever you're sort of shouting for a manager to get booted, you should always have a who would you hire instead kind of backup plan or plan for the future. And I'm sitting here just thinking, like, who would be a positive hire for England? And I'm not sure.
Ronald Koeman?
If he hadn't just taken the Everton job, totally funny if Koeman just decided to leap away from Everton. Like, that would be a laugh from a Liverpool perspective. But, who's out there? I mean, are they going to bring in Roberto Martinez? Maybe give Jurgen Klinsmann a call?
I don't think that, who I would call? Jorge Sampaoli.
Would you?
Yeah, I don't see, like, if you're looking at an international level, a guy who's going to change things up, give your team an identity, give your team a start in the right direction, look at what Jorge Sampaoli did with Chile. Chile went from being an afterthought to the two-time reigning, even though one of them is a made-up and completely fake tournament, Copa America champion. And they beat Argentina the same way both times. And you look at Chile, if I would have told you that Alexis Sanchez was going to play that game at 60% and that Arturo Vidal was going to pick up a yellow in the first, like, 15 minutes of the game, and that Chile were also going to have a player sent off with a red 20 minutes into the game, what would you have told me the final score of that game would be?
Not in Chile's favor.
Probably not, no. And instead, they showed the same balls. Now, granted, Sampaoli is not there right now, but you can still see his imprint on this team. They showed the same balls in defense, the same testicular fortitude, if you will, that they did when they beat Argentina last year. I mean, this is a team that scraped and clawed for every single ball. They shut down the best player of our era, made him a non-factor, and flummoxed him so much that he skied a penalty that caused him to quit the damn team. And they won. They just won. They looked the more dangerous team last night. They looked the better team last night. They just looked like a team. And that's something that Italy hasn't. Now, I don't know if the language barrier is there, if you could get somebody in there with the translator. But the problem with England is they think that their product has to come out of England. It doesn't.
Yes.
Like, the best coaches in the world are cultured and traveled, and they pick up a bit from here, there, and everywhere. Maybe move on from the good old boy system that has stifled English football for the better part of a decade and bring somebody in with a more modern touch.
Yeah. The English fans that I follow on Twitter have been making a big point about the idea that the English FA think that English managers are the way to go. But if you look at the top performing managers in the Premier League, for instance,
Spain,
you don't find a lot of Englishmen there.
Spain, Dutch, I mean, Spanish,
yes.
Dutch, I mean, German.
Yeah, German.
Italian.
Yeah, I mean,
anything but English.
Yeah, literally anything but English. So yeah, I mean, I guess I could see that working. He's now with Sevilla. So does he leave so quickly? For again, it's like a Ronald Koeman situation where. I mean, okay. Here's the
Well, there's a manager out there right now who used to coach in the Spanish league. He's got a big old duffel jacket just like Roy Hodgson and gives the same platitudes after every game. He's currently available to go back to La Liga. I hear he's not doing anything next year.
No, thanks. Although...
Manuel Pellegrini, for those who don't know who I'm talking about.
No, I was and I was just thinking why can't I remember his name? Because I'm dealing with this today where I can't remember anyone's name. The old Everton manager who went to Manchester United.
Mourinho?
No.
Oh, Moyes. David Moyes.
Yeah, Moyes. Yeah. You brought up Spain, and instantly I just, for some reason, thought of David Moyes. But Pellegrini wouldn't be the worst manager in the world for England to get. I mean, he'd be better than Moyes, he'd be better than Martinez.
Yes.
I
just don't know what you do.
The problem for England, honestly, I think, is it's a little bit of like, sometimes I feel like the problem for USC is who is really willing to take on that mess? The pressure of the English media, the players who are talented, but there's no national identity. England is not an easy country to manage. And honestly, I'm not sure, like, I don't know that it's a, you know, it's not a destination.
No, not really. I mean, you look at destination jobs that likely be Spain, Germany, Brazil, you know, those types of jobs, known powers. You know, England have played shoot, I mean, the last time I remember them doing anything of note was losing to Italy in the World Cup. It's just, you can only endure this for so long, going through it over and over and over again before common sense should set in and lead you down a different path. But that provides us with a perfect segue, because Lord knows we've spent enough time on England and Hodgson, to talk about another different path that another country will soon embark upon and will likely maybe find a new identity or an adjusted nature to their current identity, and that is La Roja, who went out today to the Azzurri 2-0, Chiellini scoring off of a De Gea save, kinda-ish, off a free kick, but then De Gea sort of just pushed it right into the path of an Italian attacker who got a boot on it, and it fell to Chiellini, who happily put it away from point-blank range. And
yeah,
then
it was
Graziano
fall to
Pele mercilessly cut head Spain off in the 91st minute with a volley off of a counter, which basically ended any hopes of a Spanish comeback at that point. And Italy went on to win 2-0, and Antonio Conte may have been the most pissed off man I've ever seen winning a game.
Italy, so in the rundown, I wrote 1-0 because I was thinking about defending the 1-0 victory. I forget about Italy's 2-0 tendencies where they have the 1-0 the whole way and then get that second just death nail of a goal like very, very late, even though it was really a 1-0 win. But, you know, get the 2-0 to make it look a little bit more
that's called,
boisterous.
I think the way that Ian Dark put it, or it might have been Bob Lee, the second goal ratified how dominant of a performance Italy had on the night.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Italy was just the worst matchup for Spain. Italy came with just the perfect structure, the perfect buy-in, the perfect setup.
Back three.
And I mean, they defended bravely. They defended with energy. They just sort of closed in ranks and were never going to let Spain through. And Spain looked like the Spain that looks, you know, when Spain loses, they always lose the exact same way. There's no variance. They come up against a team that defends better than they can attack. They pass the ball around aimlessly between, you know, midfield and center back, and are just, you know, can't break through a crowded defense. And it's sad to see Spain run out of options and to see Spain's system sort of get figured out the way it has. But I think that's just sort of further proof that Del Bosque is probably in his best. I mean, he's had a uber successful run. He has laid his
historic
flag.
Run. In fact,
oh, yeah.
No team had ever done that before.
Yeah. But you know, eventually systems get found out and the new generation of system comes in and everyone switches to that and everyone then figures that out. And then they, you know, it's a cycle. So Spain's Del Bosque in particular, his cycle is just done. And you know, it's probably for the best that Spain go out early here so that then they can, you know, Del Bosque can leave and Spain can figure themselves out.
Nolito can finish his transfer business to Manchester City, as can John Stones, and everybody wins.
Oh yeah, something we didn't mention about Iceland and England. The best result from this is that all of the Liverpool players get to go back to England early now, and there is a slight chance that when Liverpool come to LA that some of those players might actually see the field. So this is super exciting for me as a LA Liverpool fan. But back to Spain, you know, it was just one of those games. It was, you know, I think back to the World Cup, the way that the Dutch annihilated Spain, and I'll take this over that. You know, at least it wasn't that. It's just that there was no cutting edge for the Spanish, and I think a system adjustment is needed. But at the same time, the way that Italy play, I think Italy are the kind of team that could beat even, you know, great teams on their day just by being so disciplined and by being, you know, when you show up and have and play a game like that. When Gigi Buffon has a game
Italy,
like that.
This version of Italy, what we're currently seeing with this lockdown defense and their attackers finding ways to convert the limited chances, this Italy can win the whole damn thing. Let's just be clear about that. Like,
oh, no
this
question.
Italy could very easily win the whole thing.
Well, we talked about this on our last episode, right, where this game might decide. If Spain figured themselves out and were able to unlock this Italy team, then Spain were capable of beating anyone in the tournament. And if Italy were able to shut down Spain, keep their setup, and just put in a masterclass the way that they did, then you would have to look at Italy and say, well, why couldn't they win the whole damn thing? What's to say that they can't win
the
same thing?
And if it goes to penalty kicks, which Italy can easily get it to, I don't think enough people have mentioned how poor the Germans have shown this. But the vast majority of this team is on Bayern, and Bayern are not exactly thrilling penalty takers.
Yeah, mental blocks on penalties are a real problem, and one the Germans should take care not to put themselves in a position to have to face.
Like, if this thing goes to penalties, when the German defenders, like, I can honestly say I wouldn't bat an eye if you told me, like, Leonardo Bonucci or Giorgio Chiellini were going to take a penalty. But if you're like, we're going to send out Jerome Boateng, I would be like, huh? We're doing what? You know, basically from number one, because I wouldn't doubt Buffon's ability to take a damn penalty at this point.
It'd be like that
Brazilian goalkeeper who holds the world record for most goals off of free kicks. He's like a free kick expert. The goalie is like.
Doesn't he have crazy hair?
I'm not. I believe so, but I've only ever seen like snippets of footage and like brief references to the dude, but you might be thinking of the guy who did the scorpion save.
Is that the Colombian keeper?
Yeah, well, he looked like a Colombian keeper, but I think he was Brazilian.
No,
he might have been a Colombian.
I do a lot where I mix up people just because they have similar hairstyles, so I could be mixing them up.
It could just be that we don't know what the dude looks like. but, you know, the point here is that going from 1 to 11, Italy have guys that can take penalties who are fine to deliver in pressure situations, and I just don't feel that same way about Germany. And though you look at what the Germans did in their comprehensive victory over Slovakia, and you say, well, that German team can win the whole thing too, and that's completely true. When you look at that Italy-Germany game, where are your first thoughts? Who do you think comes out of that game and why?
My thoughts are very wishy-washy. I think at this point I have reason to believe that Italy are just too organized and so we've spent a lot of time talking about teams that don't know who they are in this tournament. We've worried about Germany, we've worried about France and England and Spain and all of these teams that were just Portugal, we're not sure who they are. Like, we know exactly who Italy are, and that gives me reason to trust their ability to just go out there and be on top of things. At the same time, I think Germany are, you know, I respect Yogi Löw a lot. I wonder if maybe he is the one who could figure out what to do about this Italy problem. I think Germany could produce a moment that just defies, you know, Italy's great defense, and Italy can be undone which is one lapse of concentration. But my overriding feeling right now, and this might just be because of what just happened today, is that I don't want to bet against Italy. I really don't. I think the team of Italy is probably the most complete in their identity at the tournament right now. And I just, yeah, I don't know that I can bet against them at this point.
Well, if you were a betting man or woman, as you would be, you might love the statistic that I'm sure everybody has heard, and that is that the Germans have never beaten the Italians ever in a competitive match.
And, I mean, okay, statistics like that don't matter until they get spoken, and then they get heard by a German player, and they get in their head, and it becomes the psychological battle. That trend might continue here. I mean, another trend that continued here was Spain lost their last five major tournament games while wearing white. So I don't know why they don't just burn the white jerseys. But then again, another meaningless statistic that still, you know, follows through.
I don't think those are meaningless in soccer, man. I didn't one club, like, completely scrap an entire uniform? Like, wasn't it, like, an Italian club that, like, had such a crappy season one year that they completely just got rid of that uniform? We're like, we're never going to wear this thing again.
I feel like I've heard that story before. I don't know what club it was, but I applaud them because I love that kind of thing. I try not to be, but I am semi-superstitious about sports. So, yeah, burn the jerseys. If you
look good.
Them, burn
yeah,
them.
Look good, feel good, play good, look like an 8-bit system, play like an 8-bit game. You know?
Yeah.
I'm kind of with you on the Germany versus Italy game. I still feel like the Germans are going to pull it out. Just, I don't, I want to bet on Italy. I feel like the Germans are entering into a zenith I don't know. I feel like this is sort of the make or break game for them. I'm reasonably sure that whoever wins this game is likely going to win the tournament, though. Of that, I'm reasonably sure. But
do you think it could be really quick? Do you think it could just come down to which goalkeeper has the best game? Like, is this literally just going to be a Buffon makes the save or Neuer makes the save?
I think this game will be won in the midfield, because that's primarily if you look at a lot of what the German team have borrowed from, it's a lot of this three back, you know, five-man midfield stuff that Guardiola adopted. And you know, he was heavily influenced by Italian defenses and Dutch defenses. And the midfield, the back lines for both of these teams are excellent. They are. The Italians probably have the best back line in the entire world, and it doesn't help it certainly doesn't help Germany's cause that they all play on the same team. Now, of course, the Germans, most of them do as well, but not across all back four. So I do think that you give an edge to Italy in the back line, but I don't know that the Italians have the presence in the midfield that the Germans have. The one thing that they do have going for them is that I think that the Germans are a bit slower to react off the ball. They're more about precision and movement, and that's something that'll suit Italy fine. They can play a game like that. It's going to be a tactical and tricky sort of matchup, but I think it's going to be one in the midfield more than either keeper doing what they do, because I feel like Neuer and Buffon are of such a class that whatever happens, I mean, they may have, you know, a howler, it could happen to anybody, but you generally have a feeling that whatever beats Neuer, whatever beats Buffon is going to be worthy. You know, it's sort of like Thor's hammer. Whichever ball finds itself in the net shall be worthy of, you know, to call itself Thor. It'd be something along those lines. I feel like the midfield is where Italy can possibly have some problems, but if they're able to stretch the German team and sort of use their speed along the edges, I think it could get interesting. That's what they did with the Belgians, and it seemed to work out just fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely going to be one of the more tactically interesting matchups there. And I totally agree with you. If the winner or the at least whichever team out of this side of the bracket gets out, if it doesn't come from one of these two, then I will be genuinely shocked. You know, maybe France has woken up and just become the juggernaut that we think. But these two have got to be the favorites. And just I think it's interesting the way that this bracket has worked out, in that the Spain-Italy game felt a lot like a semifinal, and this Italy-Germany game is going to feel a lot like a final, even though it's just not just the way that things shook out. But the caliber of team there, you have to think, in a weird way, with Italy, it's like the sort of going backwards, where the hardest team that you faced was the first one, and then they get progressively easier as you progress to the final. Like, I don't know that Germany or Italy are going to face anyone tougher than themselves in this matchup.
Speaking of tough matchups, Portugal and Poland will also square off in one of our quarterfinal matchups. Poland, of course, participating in the shootout thriller against Switzerland in what turned out to be a battle of two halves and a very fairly entertaining extra time. Portugal, on the other hand, came off of the most boring game in the history of boring games.
The worst.
Becoming the first teams, in the entire history of this tournament not to lodge a single shot on goal in regulation, and didn't officially put a shot on goal until the 115th minute of the game. If you are ever having problems falling asleep, pull up your Watch ESPN app, load up Portugal versus Croatia, and just sit back. You will be out before you know it. Do you think that Poland and Portugal will up the ante in terms of excitement? Because neither one of those teams have been immensely exciting when they've played, and now they're going to play each other. So it kind of feels like almost a dead rubber.
Yeah, well, and the problem with Portugal-Croatia was that neither team wanted to – I mean, they were both just sort of like boxers circling each other in the ring, and no one going forward and actually throwing a damn punch. They were both kind of playing scared in that sense. Poland, I don't know what to make of Poland, because every time I watch them, I just think that Lewandowski should be doing something more, and that they should be just a step better than they are. But I don't know if maybe that's just because they're not a step better than they are. And I'm not sure that, you know, the Switzerland and Poland, I don't know that anything was really decided in that game. I think it was fitting that it ended up in penalties, and that just sort of the coin toss that was. Portugal, I'm just going to say this, anytime Portugal is involved, it's going to come down to Ronaldo. It's going to come down to whether or not he does something brilliant, and that might be the difference in the game.
And Lewandowski, you know, could actually show up for a game at some point in this tournament.
Yeah, but my worry is that my hope would be that Poland prevents this from happening. But my worry is that because Portugal has Cristiano Ronaldo, and everyone knows that they want that they can be lethal on the break as a result. Is Poland gonna go in there and think to themselves, like, well, we just need to make sure that we don't let Portugal break, which means that we're going to hold back on throwing everyone forward in the attack if we really need to. And I worry it's just going to be another repeat of exactly the same problem that happened on Saturday with those two teams is, you know, is Poland going to go for it? Is Portugal going to go for it? I don't know what to expect from either of these teams because they've, Portugal especially, have been, you know, they seem to be playing the individual game that's sort of in front of them and not giving us a lot of reason to expect one way or another what's going to happen the next time around.
Yeah, it's nearly impossible for me to care or pick a winner in this game. It's sort of, I'm looking more forward to any of the other matchups than I am this one, which probably means this will turn out to be like Portugal-Hungary, where it's been, you know, 3-3 barn burner. And then another three goals per team in extra time, and then we go to penalties, and it'll be one in the 11th round of an all-timer.
I vote for that.
I also vote for that. We deserve it after being denied penalties in Portugal versus Croatia. Touching on Wales and Belgium, a very, very, very scary Belgium team beat the holy hell out of their – wow, why am I drawing a blank on their last opponent?
Out of Hungary, just because we both thought that Hungary might do in Belgium. It was
quite the opposite.
Yeah.
Eden Hazard came to life. Kevin De Bruyne has returned to his original brilliant form, delivering brilliant ball into spaces. Hazard just did what he did last year. Well, I suppose it's 2 years ago now when he was the PFA Player of the Year and just proved that when you have two guys like him, and De Bruyne, and plus somebody up front in Lukaku who is really built to hold up play and allow this Belgian team to sort of get forward in numbers. And Lukaku himself has shown him to be a brilliant passer of the ball as well. They just dismantled Hungary and are now on to Wales. Who are one of those teams that have been playing as a team, maybe a bit over-reliant upon Gareth Bale, but not nearly to the point where you could look at it and say it was as bad as sort of Ronaldo or some of these other countries that have one major player and they just feed the ball to him. I kind of feel like Belgium's going to come away with this one. I think Belgium are sort of destined to get to the finals at this point. Then again, they could just as easily have another crappy game. But I feel like this should be pretty straightforward for Belgium. I think Wales will defend admirably, but I think over time that Belgium will just wear them down. I don't think Wales offer enough going forward to worry about the fact that what are essentially four center backs or two center halves will be playing as fullbacks. Like, Bale's the only real guy that you have to worry about, but when you've got Thibaut Courtois in goal and the center back pairing that they do have, they're going to feel pretty comfortable if he gets out on a breakaway. They know that they have cover on defense, so I think that Wales will put up a fight, but I think Belgium are gonna win out in the end, and that probably means they'll go out losing to Wales 3-0.
Well, I mean, the fighting Joe Allens are fun. I think I agree with you. I think they do have one of those team mentalities that's a little bit of a better blend of the Portugal superstar kind of situation, but with the team sort of being more behind it. I think Wales will fight valiantly, but you just get the feeling that they need to sit there and hope that De Bruyne and Hazard have games that are the opposite of what they had against Hungary and more akin to what they look like in the group stage. Because we talk, like, De Bruyne had a really, really crappy first game, Hazard looked like a passenger, which, you know, sometimes he does. Sometimes the team carries him, and the danger of him is that when he wakes up, holy hell, he wakes up. So Wales will just sort of have to sit there and hope, well, hopefully Hazard is asleep today. Hopefully De Bruyne can't pick a pass, just sort of cannot get it on target. And then they'll have a chance for Bale to do something brilliant. It's a game that I don't think it's going to get out of hand the way that the Hungary game got out of hand, because I think Wales might be a little bit more tactically cynical about not allowing Belgium to sort of romp. But yeah, that if that was an awakening for Belgium,
well,
in that,
but
in
Wales
that
also
round,
usually play with five at the back too. So you have to figure that as Belgium go to pivot and counter, which, my God, they're just deadly, probably the deadliest team on the counter, just because in terms of the overall team speed and brilliance in passing, when you've got guys like Hazard and De Bruyne who are quick in their own right but can also pass the daylight out of the ball, it opens up a lot of avenues with clever runs and supporting runs for little layoffs and such. But, you know, Hungary came in full force, and then they just didn't have the number to deal with the Belgians when they got going in the counter. I don't think Wales will be as aggressive going forward. I think that they're not going to commit as many numbers forward. I think they'll take their chances where they can get them, realize that free set pieces and free kick opportunities, you know, they're going to be as worried about Kevin De Bruyne and his set piece ability as Thibaut Courtois is going to be of Gareth Bale and his set piece ability. So I think that comes out a wash. Wales can win this. Don't get me wrong. Belgium have shown themselves to sort of mentally check out if they fall behind. And a comprehensive team like Wales can take advantage of that. But I feel like what you were talking about with waves and waves and waves of attackers, just that England should have had, we will see with Belgium.
Right.
And they're just going to put too many shots on goal. It won't be as bad as what they did to the U.S., but I think that they can probably get about half those shots, about 15 shots on goal, I think is fair.
Yeah, Wales will have to survive the onslaught and then, like you said, like take their moment with a free kick or just sort of the one or two chances they get, they got to bury them. Belgium can afford to sort of use the machine gun approach where you just fire away and see what sticks. But, you know, in the sense that, like, the Germany-Italy game is going to be just like a tactical chess match, this game is going to – I really think talent could win out either way here. Whether or not Belgium –
the Wales go to pivot and counter too. You got to remember that they've got Aaron Ramsey, Joe Allen, and Gareth Bale getting forward, and each of those guys are extremely talented. Like, look, man, they're just as capable of producing an individual moment of magic as anyone across the front of Belgium. So it's not like Wales, even if they don't commit numbers forward, don't still have the individual quality to produce something when they do get up there.
Right. And I just have the feeling that it's going to come down to the moment when, you know, one side or the other, Wales or Belgium, is going to make the most of their moments versus the other one, as opposed to necessarily, like, you know, they're going to come out with the tactics they come out with. It's going to be like sort of two armies just facing each other, knowing exactly what everyone else is going to do. And then whoever's strength wins out. So I, in that sense, I think it's going to be a fun game to watch. Hopefully. I'm probably jinxing it because I say that, but hopefully it will be. And then I guess, I mean, we can talk about another game that's going to be super fun to watch because Iceland is involved with it, but the game I'm most looking forward to now is that France-Iceland deal, because storylines, holy heck, storylines.
Yeah, and that is our final, you know, sort of match preview that we have here. Man, I feel like we've sort of set the table for everything, actually done a really good job of setting the table. This game has the potential to be a carbon copy of what we saw today. Like, it could so very easily be France getting out in front, and then if they don't make the same mistake as England did and are able to maybe frustrate Iceland, because every time Iceland has been scored upon in this tournament, they respond rather quickly. And I'd be curious to see how this team would respond if they've only trailed for 7 minutes at any point in the tournament or something. I mean, the thing is, like, now in every game in which they've played, the grand total of time that Iceland's had to play from behind is like 9 minutes. That's nothing. That's a Taco Bell fart. And you know, England couldn't even manage more than like a minute before they answered back. And if France can get a quick goal, because they probably more than England have so much individual quality on the ball that there is no reason that they couldn't produce wave after wave after wave of attacks. Like, I mean, this might be the second most talented team, and it doesn't even have all of its best players. It's, you know, it's not, they don't have Rafael Varane out there. They don't have Karim Benzema. Mateo Valbuena doesn't seem to be playing a role. France, you look at what Griezmann's been able to do in this tournament, call him an opportunist. I think the dude's just basically a smaller, Frenchier version of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. He just sort of has that quality to where he's always in front of the net because he puts himself in positions to score.
That's an underrated quality because it's an unquantifiable quality. But having the nose and the instinct to be in the right place at the right time, not everyone has that. So, yeah, I'm totally with you. Like, Griezmann is a special player for that reason, just having the sense and the instinct to know, I'm going to be here, or even if it's just pure luck. I mean, luck wins you games. Luck wins you a hell of a lot of games, if that's what you want to call it. So France has the players. France is one of the more dangerous looking teams in the whole tournament. It's just that when we look at France, they're like England light in the psychological mental sense. The difference being that France has been able to pull stuff away, you know, a little bit more consistently and without, you know, as much drama as England was in the knockout rounds, at least. I worry that France, the pressure of being the home country, of being in front of their fans, of the crowd maybe, you know, turning against them if they don't take control of this game right away. I agree. I think this game could turn into what Iceland and England did. France isn't quite as mentally fragile as England, but it's not like they're not hardened winners out there. This is still a team that is recovering from a complete meltdown in the last major tournament, lead up to the last major tournament. And I wonder if France has the sort of the cojones to deal with what Iceland is surely going to throw at them, because Iceland are playing with house money. Iceland are just there for the party.
The Iceland can get shellacked 3-0 by France and nobody's going to care. Like,
and they'd still have a party. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that's dangerous. That makes them very dangerous. And France is going to have to guard themselves against falling into the sort of favorite against the underdog, Goliath and David and all that kind of stuff situation from happening.
Well, it's not quite European, but with the little time we have remaining here before we get, because we've already done a decent show here, I do want to talk about a man who spent the vast majority of his life in Europe, yet played for a South American team until said team lost to Chile in the made-up Copa America tournament. Lionel Messi, in the United States, of all places, Lionel Messi has announced his international retirement. A lot of people think that, you know, Argentina can come back out, kiss his ass, for lack of a better term, and things will be good. I don't think it's quite that simple, and I think that anyone who's paid a decent amount of attention to Messi and his saga with Argentina realized that this has gotten way more than personal. I mean, there have been threats against his family. His family has been abused at matches, and people have tried to assault them. This is the kind of stuff goes way beyond getting peppered in the press or getting slated in the press for not being enough of a leader. This is having a drunkard and a cokehead like Maradona talk about how you're not being a leader for your team, as if that guy was a paragon of virtue when he graced the pitch with his presence. This is just a cluster F of problems for Argentina, and they expect Messi to solve them all. And he wasn't the only one that retired. I didn't get the names, but several other key figures have expected that they're going to announce their retirement from the Argentine national team as well. And you have to think that that's A, in support of Messi, but B, as part of a larger statement saying, like, look, man, this is garbage. You know, I mean, I hate to do this to my boy, but I mean, those DirecTV commercials, you know, this is so-and-so with cable. Sergio Aguero, man, when he puts on the Albi Celeste, the dude looks like he has cable. But when he goes back to Manchester City, it looks like he's got DirecTV. I love that analogy. You know, he and Higuain have bottled so many chances for the Argentine. Like, Higuain does not get enough. He's now missed an open damn goal in the last three finals. The last three major finals in which Argentina has played, Higuain has had the net in front of him with it all to do, actually with nothing to do, but put the ball in each of them. World Cup final against Neuer, gotten around him, puts it wide. Copa America final against Chile in the dying seconds of extra time, right before PKs, he puts a ball, he was basically gifted the inside post, and he puts it on the outside of the net. And there again last night, he missed again. And yet, for all of the commentary in South America, it's been about how Messi hasn't done this, Messi hasn't done that. And it's like, well, look, man, maybe if our strikers were doing, you know, their job of striking the ball, you wouldn't need me to be an individual master.
Yeah, teams win tournaments, not individuals. And I did think Messi was frustrated against Chile. I think he was trying a little bit too hard to do it all by himself. But that was a crazy game with some refereeing decisions that just sort of turned the game on its head. It was 10-10. It was just a sort of weird situation that whole ending, the whole final, the whole who got to lift the trophy thing, the way it was determined was, it almost just felt like random at a certain point. To clarify, or to answer one of your questions about the players who are considering retiring from Argentina, it's Sergio Aguero and several others. So I don't think they were named, but there's just a bunch of them who are.
I figured Sergio Aguero was in there because he's cool. He's Lionel's best friend. Like, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, when I say it's his best friend, that's his best friend. So I kind of figured that Aguero was going to. Yeah, he hasn't been that great anyway.
Well, and it seems to be an issue of just the pressures of being in, you know, having so much on your plate from a national perspective. I know that Messi was also really frustrated by the organization of the Argentinian FA, the way it's being run, how efficient it's being run, all of that kind of stuff. So I'm sure that plays a part in this
whole
drama. But
the number of people implicated in CONCACAF and CONMEBOL over the past couple of years, and you know, if you look at Brazil, I mean, just what's about to happen in Rio is going to be nothing short of hilariously disastrous. Another podcast, another time. There are so many problems with the Argentine FA. Argentinian FA, whatever, and Messi's had to shoulder the vast majority of the blame for it. I don't think it's fair. I think that that's a completely capable team, and not enough questions are truthfully asked of what's supposed to be his supporting role. Like I said, I hate to do this to Aguero, but he's one of the best strikers in the Premier League. I mean, he actually is the best striker in the Premier League, but by most consensus opinions, when healthy. But looks like a different player, and maybe it comes down to the fact that they're not using a system that benefits these guys. I don't know, but Aguero has to do better. If he had that kind of production at Manchester City, people would be, you know, celebrating Wilfred Bonny, probably, you know. But as fans, he has Wilfred Bonny-like production for the Albi Celeste, and you can't have that. And I already talked about Higuain and his opportunities to give Argentina some glory. And, you know, Angel Di Maria was the most expensive transfer in English history until the most expensive transfer in English history. It's not like he's playing with crap and a ball of dicks up front, you know? Like, he's got some really, really, really talented and expensive players, and nobody seems to be asking the same questions of them like they do Messi, talking about his legacy this and his legacy that. Like they define his legacy because Higuain couldn't hit the broadside of the barn.
Yeah, and, you know, one thing that's really interesting, I mean, his retirement makes a lot of sense in the context of I was listening to the Dan Patrick Show a couple weeks ago right after the Cavs won the NBA Finals, and he had Richard Jefferson on. And Richard Jefferson was talking about how exhausting the playoffs are. And even though they won, he didn't know that, you know, he retired briefly, I guess. He might be coming back, but he didn't want to continue and come back for another season, even if it was with the Cavs where he might win another title, because the NBA Finals was so exhausting. The process of going through a series where every game is life or death is really, really exhausting. So you can sort of imagine Messi looking at this, maybe being in the emotion of the moment, which is why a lot of people think that this might be just a temporary thing and that he'll eventually come out of his senses when he's removed from it. But you think about the prospect of having to – this is somebody who's been as long in a tournament, in tournaments, the last three big ones that Argentina have been in, without – getting the you know, the emotional relief of lifting the damn trophy. So they have played a lot of games, dealt with a lot of stress, and then not gotten the reward for it. Looking forward at the World Cup in a couple of years, you can sort of see him thinking, like, is it worth it expending that much energy if, you know, it's a very, 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 very real chance that we might not win it, because, you know, only one team does. There's a lot of other powers that are competing in there trying to get there, and it was hard enough just to get to the final only to lose it. Emotionally, I totally understand the exhaustion of that. But at the same time, while I do think that I agree there's just a lot of issues going on there, it wouldn't surprise me all that much if, you know, a few months down the line, with a little rest, he might consider it more, reconsider his decision. But I think he's entitled to make that decision at this point.
I also have to imagine, too, that he's not really going to be in his prime, after Russia 2018. And so here's the way that Messi's looking at this is, after this, we're going to have to do another Copa America because, it's supposed to be every 2 years, but it's not the real Copa America's fault that they had a fake one. And there's still Confederations Cup. There's still all of this stuff that Argentina are going to have to go through. I guess they wouldn't play in the Confederations Cup. That would be Chile. But you just look at, as you said, the top end football that Argentina will be expected to play, and you also have to wonder if Messi's not looked at this thing and said, I don't think it gets better from here. Messi understands the game better than anyone. And if you're looking at that Argentine team and saying, okay, Aguero's probably got less of a shelf life than we'd like him to have due to his injury rate, and he's not been that productive as it is. Higuain, going to be Higuain. If you're Messi right now, I don't know how much trust you have in Higuain. Angel Di Maria seems to do a lot or does nothing. And you have to figure that the overall influence that these players are going to have on the game is only going to wear down over time. Can you really sustain this at the level at which Argentina would be expected to sustain, which is nothing short of a final or the actual individual trophy? And I just wonder if Messi's looked at it and said, dude, we're not going to win moving forward. And you guys are going to blame me when we don't.
Yeah. And Messi will carry the blame. He's been in what, 3 World Cups? Most players, three World Cups is their max. The longevity of being an international player, it's not the special players do more than that, but it's not all that common to be able to participate in that many. So it's not like it would be completely unprecedented, although I think he could definitely play at a high level, but I'm with you. Unless Argentina comes up with somebody to take the reins from him and be the star, then you're right. I don't know that he's not going to be better in this coming World Cup than he was in the last World Cup. And, in the last World Cup, they still fell short, even though he was, completely in.
And now they're falling short to Chile. Now you're not even you are, even though you're the number one team in the world, you are now consecutively two years in a row not even the best team in your own region. So that that's going to have to eventually, that number one ranking is going to slip away. I imagine that whoever wins the Euros will move into that number one slot.
The one thing though is that, think about the nice edge that these things sit on. I mean, these two Copa Americas have come down to penalty kicks, and
Argentina has not been close either time.
Right, but the point is that it's not like you've lost, like you've been outclassed. You've gotten to penalty kicks, and when you get to penalty kicks.
And I think this winner came at 118, didn't it?
Oh yeah, it came at the death.
Yeah.
They've come about as close as you possibly could. So
they literally played an extra game. A half hour.
Yeah. And it's just interesting how the way that the ball bounces sometimes in these things, the sort of butterfly effect of sports is that this domino effect of just some very, very, very late moments of just not quite getting there can have this much of an effect on somebody's entire career. but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't take away from the exhaustion of it all.
And certainly not at the international level. Yeah, yeah. I imagine when you have the weight of a nation on your shoulders, it's a bit different, man. You see, you see what it meant to LeBron, and that was just the city of Cleveland, man. Like,
I know, right?
just the city of Cleveland. So, you know, well, that's a good place to leave it. Obviously, we're not going to unretire or get the final word on Messi tonight. But I know we'll be back after the quarterfinal to sort of talk about what we were wrong about miserably. And what we were right about, we did okay in our predictions, I feel like we'll do better this time around, mostly because so just to be clear here at the end, you're taking Italy. Where do you sit, France v Iceland?
Oh, okay. Italy. I'm going France because I don't want to jinx Iceland. I'm going Belgium, and I'm going Poland.
I'm going to take Portugal because of I was looking at their last year. Leading into this tournament, one of the major Portuguese newspapers had put out their last results, and Portugal are a consistent team as you'll ever see. It's usually almost always semifinal, final, and then there's a smattering of quarterfinals in there. So I think Portugal, simply by just doing this every single time, will get past Poland. I'm taking Belgium over Wales. I think I'm going to take the champions over the Italians, and I'm going to stick with you and not jinx Iceland. I'm going to pick France, which probably jinxes France. So I'm okay with that. Any last thoughts before we get out of here?
No, it's been fun, and as I've enjoyed the days of multiple games every day, and we've now entered the sort of like resting time of we get a reprieve until Thursday, and there's only one game a day. So a little bit more focus on the individual things, but
our summer
of
soccer is winding down.
Yeah, and that's kind of bittersweet, right?
Yeah, but you know what, though? You and I might are in this boat, but we have two club teams that we are ridiculously excited to see what they will be now in their first full year with a new man in charge that definitely has a set plan and a set tactical and development system in place. So getting over the Euros and the Olympics and into the start of the Premier League season, even as you said, the preseason, is something that I can't wait for. So on the one hand, I'm really, really sad that the summer of soccer is coming to an end. But on the other, that just means that the Premier League season is that much closer. And I am so ready for the era of Pep that you don't even know.
I am ready for this season as well. So that's a perfect way to look at it. Always onward and upward.
Indeed. And again, you can find us on Twitter, @ Penguin of Troy, myself @ Fight on Twist, and you could also follow the site for which she writes @ Reign of Troy, and feel free to follow along with Athlon and our good hosts here at Blog Talk Radio, who are gracious enough to give us the air space we want to have our fun. So with that, we will wrap this episode up, and we will catch you next time here on Now You're Up with Alicia and Josh.